Hey, Lex Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Premium guys, I love you to death. This is actually an interesting podcast. I got Coach Holman from University of Utah. We get to learn a lot about his program. Distinguished career, great goalie at Hopkins years ago, parent of a great player, obviously. Has put together an unbelievable coaching staff. Talks about the growth of lacrosse in Utah and kind of the statewide commitment that I think you'll find interesting. Practice plans are really kind of interesting. Obviously, just coming out of North Carolina, where he was 8 years with an ACC championship as well as a national championship. I found him to be a really, really interesting guy, almost kind of a generalist in terms of perspective and the way he looks at things. If you go to their website and see any of the videos, they've done a great job there on the videos. You see his passion as well. Anyway, I learned a lot. I thought it was a great, great opportunity to learn about this new coach at a program that will certainly be on the rise. Coach Brian Holman, Utah.
Hey, Lex Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Today's a special day. Live from the world headquarters of LexCoachMike.com in beautiful Atlanta, Georgia. You've been sending me emails, and I didn't do a good job of following up. We welcome today somebody you've been asking for, Coach Brian Holman from the Utah Utes, getting ready to go. Coach, welcome to LexCoachMike.com.
Oh, Mike, I love it. You know, somebody older than me has more passion.
Oh, come on. I didn't need that right at the beginning, man. You should save that. You gotta save that. You can't be laying that on me right at the beginning.
Start out with a zinger and let's go. So
well, that's the reason we have to do. Yeah, that's the reason we have to do the podcast in the morning here, Eastern Standard Time, because you know at 1 o'clock they serve lunch at the home, and I got to be back in the lunchroom where they grind the food up. So
that's great.
All good. Yeah. Hey man, give me a. I think everybody's pretty familiar with the As you know, I mean, you know, my audience is far more sophisticated than a lot of people come on here think in terms of lacrosse X's and O's, and I think everybody knows who you are. I think everybody knows your history, maybe not the Hopkins history, but certainly the North Carolina history. And I encourage them to go on the website, and they do a great job with these videos on how all this started and got going, but. Let me ask you two questions and give us a thumbnail overview of where you go in fall of 2018, coming into 2019. The biggest thing that attracted you to the position, and the biggest thing that has surprised you now that you've been there a little bit.
Awesome. Yeah. Great questions, Mike. And again, thanks for having me on.
Oh, now you're going to patronize me after you stab me in the back.
Big
that
fan
doesn't fly, man. You already you set the tone for this deal, man. It's over now. Yeah, don't try and kiss up now.
So you know, where we are is, you know, we're 2 years in. Obviously, we came out and we took over an existing club program that was here at Utah, and I'll tell you, Mike, that was a phenomenal experience. I think in a really broad perspective, we have established what I would consider a really good blueprint for any other universities or schools that want to take this project on. So, you know, the 2 years with the club team were literally, you know, from day one, we started instituting our cultural-based program and the way we're going to practice and the way we're going to approach the game of lacrosse. And you know, it didn't matter whether these kids were club players, you know, or Division I lacrosse players. Our mentality was the same. So we've had the benefit of you know, laying some serious groundwork, you know, for the past 2 years and leading into this Division I step. Now, you know, the bridge, as you know, and anybody
else. Well, and I don't think people out east have any clue.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I don't think they have the appropriate respect for Brigham Young, Colorado, Colorado State, Arizona in a given year, Chapman,
California,
Manny at Grand Valley.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get west of the Mississippi, I don't think people understand the caliber of lacrosse. You know, they think, oh, these guys, you know, they weren't playing any. And maybe that's a difference between your journey and Michigan's journey, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Michigan never played the schedule that you guys play.
Yeah. No,
you know, before they went D1.
I'm with you. I was the top 10, 12 programs in club lacrosse are two things. One, they're very, very, very well coached. You know, they're very well run. They're extremely organized and they're relatively talented. And, you know, so that was a great eye opener for me. And, you know, and two, in a bigger picture for us, Mike, as you know, obviously it's about starting another Division I program. And for us, it's about competing at the highest levels, but also one of the goals and the missions of my staff and one of the reasons we're all together is that, you know, we want to do our best. And what we're called to do of paying the game back and growing the game. So how do you grow the game? You grow it through your operations. You grow it through grassroots. You grow it through, you know, taking chances, you know, pushing yourself outside your box, your comfort zone. So coming out here and having our eyes opened up, to what's happening out this way, really has affected me as far as what I'm considering looking at as the growth of lacrosse. So, you know, that was an awesome experience for us. It challenged us. It allowed us a couple years as a staff to kind of work out some kinks, and we'll continue to do that. But now we cross a really big bridge, and there is a huge chasm between, the bottom end of the club scene and then Division I lacrosse. So, you know,
and
the
Coach,
good part.
Coach,
of
it, I don't know where to insert this, but I have to insert it.
Yeah.
And I know we don't delegate up in this organization, and you're a great coach, and I'm like, you know, club coach. When I heard what you all have done, you all being the macro university level, you know, this all happened simultaneously in Utah. You can go watch these videos on their site, and you got to do it, man, because it's so eye-opening in terms of the commitment to youth lacrosse in the area. I think it was, didn't the one guy say on the video it was the same year that it was a approved high school federation sport or whatever the correct nomenclature is? So this is an all-encompassing thing, man. I mean, Utah's all in.
Yes. And it had to be that way. That was the only way this is going to work at the scale that we wanted to work at. So, you know, people ask me why, you know, one of the things you just asked, you know, why Utah? Well, when I felt like this was like almost like a petri dish to some degree, and that there was so much support within the university and the school to make this a broad-based effort. This wasn't just about the Holman family coming out to Utah and having to be a Division I or being a coach of a lacrosse team. That was the furthest thing, from our minds. This was, how do we take all of what we learned and the blessings that lacrosse has given us and the good Lord and be able to expose other people to it? And we don't have all the answers, but we sure have a lot of experience and a lot of fun, you know, kind of making it work. And the community out here was just wide arm. I mean, you had people that have been, as you know, across this country, there are people doing the groundwork like yourself. Behind the scenes that nobody knows about, that are coaching youth leagues, that are starting youth programs in California and Wyoming and Texas and Oklahoma. And, well, you know, they don't get recognized. And what they're same people were here in Utah. You know, there was a group of people that had really just built the youth leagues up from scratch into close to 10,000 kids playing lacrosse within 35 miles of our campus.
Oh my God, you're kidding.
Yeah, when I met with all those parties and I realized that everybody had the right interest, and it was the interest of the kids and it was the interest of the game. That was it. That was the motivating factor. And to me, that's what it's always been about with lacrosse. I'm not pious and I'm not almighty, and lacrosse has given me pretty much everything I have in my life. So, you know, when I felt that, and then I felt the university say, hey, look, you know, we're like a whiteboard here. What do we have to do to build one of the best programs, in college lacrosse? So to me, it was a no-brainer once I felt that. Leaving Chapel Hill wasn't easy. You know, all three of my kids played and went to school there. My wife and I were heavily entrenched at the university. She was, director of ops for Jenny for 7 years. And I had my role with Coach Bresch for 8 or 9 years and, you know, there's a lot of ties there, but this was a place where we're literally, there's no way we could say no. So, that was the main focus on us coming out here. And now
and you look good in red, man, on the videos. You look good in red. I can't pull red off. I can't pull it off, you know?
Well, it has something to do with, well, I won't get into that. But anyway, all right. Go ahead. So we're here and now we're making this transition to Division I. So, we're excited about what the fall is going to bring. We've got probably 85 to 90 kids that are going to try out for our first lacrosse team. And that tryout will take place right after Labor Day for four or five days. And, you know, we'll pare that down to make a roster probably the following week. And then those kids will be our first, team moving into the season in 2019. And we got a great schedule. We got 15 games set right now. And
I couldn't find the schedule. Where is that?
It's in my head. So it's not, it's not posted yet. We're going to confirm all the games, but I was just kind of curious
because I went to look to see what your schedule might look like.
I'll have it out probably first part of October, last part of September. So I want to confirm everybody once they get back in September. But, you know,
this is not Joe Blow doing this podcast, right? This is somebody that does extensive research.
I'll throw some names, you know, obviously Denver and Air Force. Vermont's going to come out. Coach Price is going to come out and open us up in early February. Mercer, Furman, Hofstra, UMass, Duke, UVA. So those are some names that are on the schedule out of the 15. Let me back up a second, Mike. I'm extremely grateful for the college coaches. They've really reached out to us, because if we didn't get games, that's going to be an issue for other universities looking to establish Division I programs. You know, great, Utah can go out there and say all they want, but, you know, Coach Holman's playing nobody. So now what's going to happen with our program? So the Division I coaches really did an awesome, awesome job making my life easy, helping me scheduling games this year. And you know, again, you're looking about the greater good. That was something that's going to help us and the lacrosse world immensely once people see our schedule moving forward. So,
well, that's a tribute to you too, Coach.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. I believe that our community, you know, when it all boils down to, is going to do the right thing. And that was a big help in doing the right thing, is getting us some games. So,
as long as they're not coming out to recruit, you know, when I was coaching at McIntosh. You know, we had a new program, and we finally built credibility, and, you know, Troy Kemp is a friend, right? And I know his son.
At the end
of the day, you know, Macaulay came down to schedule us, or came down to play us, and I'm going, oh, man, we've reached credibility. Macaulay wants to come play McIntosh, okay? And after the game, we had a cookout for them. They were going to watch one of your games or something like that. You know, next thing you know, I'm getting emails from my three parents going, we're thinking about going to Macaulay. Coach Kemp had a nice talk with my guy after the game. I get a call from, I hope he listens to this, man. He's a member of my site. And he calls me up. He goes, hey, man, you don't need to come to us. We're coming back to Atlanta. Great game. I mean, they beat us by like 3 or something. And but they were always in control. I mean, they were good teams, man. And
well, you know, there's no honor amongst thieves. You know that.
Yeah, I'm going like, no way, man. I mean, you, and I want my hot dog back.
By the way.
I'm just kidding.
That's great.
So, hey, listen, you know, we're moderately familiar with the North Carolina morning practice and the routines and Coach Bresch's attention to detail. I'm real anxious to hear and understanding that fall ball is totally different than spring, and you've got guys on your roster right now that are legitimate D1 guys and guys that hopefully can develop into D1 guys. Anytime you start a program, like, or come in a transition mode the way you guys are from MCLA to D1. But can you walk us through what you think a general practice outline might look like?
Yeah, sure. I think you used a really good word there. Part of our program's culture is to develop, you know, to develop the young man as a person. I think that's probably where I, you know, I don't want to say excel, but that's a lot of my attention goes into these guys on, you know, what type of people they are, what type of people they want to be. How do I help them get there and grow? You know, my staff is pretty well known.
Oh my gosh. You got like an all-star coaching staff.
We do, and if you don't mind, Mike, I'd like to take a few minutes and talk about those guys, because I don't think they get enough press on their own. But from my perspective, what I saw in these guys is, you know, I'll start with Marcus. Obviously, he's my son, and people say, "Well, he's your son, that's why he's there." And I just tell people, I have another son. He's not here, so you know, it doesn't make Matthew a bad kid. It just means he's not a great, you know, he's not a great, you know, potentially be a great coach. Marcus has all the trappings of being a wonderful, wonderful coach down the road. He's, you know, passionate for the game. His playing ability has made him the, you know, Marcus isn't the fastest, quickest, you know, most dynamic player in the world. I think anybody can watch him play would say that. And we joke about it all the time. But what's made Mark so good is that he has had this incredible work ethic, probably larger than anybody I've ever been around in 30 years of coaching lacrosse. And he has an incredible sense of the game, and he's willing to learn the game. So he's watched an inordinate amount of film. He understands slide patterns. He understands weaknesses in defenders. You know, so all those things that allowed him to be a good lacrosse player has now going to allow him to be a good lacrosse coach. So he's got that part of it in it. Now, I tell this story to people all the time about Will and Adam. I was in charge of Coach Bresch's camps, you know, kind of organizing them and growing them and hiring people to work those camps. Well, Will and Adam both worked a majority of our camps at Carolina over the years. And I got a chance to see them firsthand.
Oh, interesting.
Instruction.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so as those things were happening, you know, I never was at Carolina with the intent of being a head lacrosse coach anywhere. I went there, really to be involved in the game. I leapt off a bridge that my wife allowed me to jump off of. And it was a really hard decision for my family and I. We were entrenched in Baltimore, lived in the same house for 21 years, same church, same neighborhood, coached every single kid in rec league in Baltimore. And so we jumped off this bridge and the good Lord blessed us greatly by going to Carolina. And what I did with Joe was I was a volunteer and I didn't have any income. People thought I was independently wealthy and that was not the truth. And so Fresh said, look, you build my camps up and that'll be the way you earn money. And lo and behold, we did. And we got there was like 300 kids involved total in Carolina camps. When I left there, there was well over 1500 kids involved in Carolina camps. And I'm proud of that. But I would watch these young men coach and I would just make mental notes and I'd go back to my room at night, you know, when we had instructional camp, or I'd go home at night and I would jot down a few things of what I saw. And, you know, guys like Will Manny and Adam Gittleman were always at the top of the list. So, you know, I just said to myself one day, man, if I ever get a job, I'd like to have these two young men with me. And lo and behold, here we are. And, you know, I tell this story too, and this is for young coaches out there. We were at the last session, and you know how this is, of a road show that we, Coach Bresch and I took up north. We went through, you know, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Philadelphia, and I forget, in Long Island. And we would do it at the end of the summer. And it was kind of Joe's and I's way of giving back to the community. We would have these two-day day camps. We made no money, but we took a lot of our players with us. And we had a blast. We'd stay in nice hotels and we'd eat great food. And that's how we spent our money. And the kids made money, obviously, right? So, we were at the last session, 15 days straight. We had 2 days off, Mike, in August. Okay. Before the home new dead period thing came into play. And it's 100 degrees and we're on the last session in Philadelphia of almost 15 days straight of coaching lacrosse. And I look down the other end of the field and Marcus Holman and Will Manny are running this drill like it's the first day of fall lacrosse practice, right? So that is what I'm looking for in a coaching staff. And then the beyond that point, Mike, you know, you're talking about some of the greatest human beings you'd ever want to meet. You know, all three of these young men have had to work their rear ends off to be great players. And that's a mentality that we want at Utah lacrosse is, you know, hard work pays off. And you don't have to be the greatest athlete. You don't have to be the biggest guy. Will's 5'8", weighs 155 pounds. He's arguably having one of the best years in MLL lacrosse this year. just one of the most valuable players for the Lizards. You know, Mark's 5'10", weighs 185 pounds. Adam's 5'8", weighs 190 pounds. But they use what God gave them, and they work hard, and they have a true passion for the game. So, anyhow, I know that's a long diatribe, and I apologize for that, but I don't think people realize how talented these young men are on the lacrosse coaching aspect of things. Forget about all their accolades on the lacrosse field. So I'm blessed. I have three guys that love the game. I focus a lot of my attention on the bigger picture things. How do we want to look as a program? How are our teams going to practice? What is the mentality of the Utah lacrosse program? You know, what is the greater good? What is the big picture of this program 10, 15, 20, 25 years down the road? Day in and day out, these guys are coming up with drills like nobody's business. I am not a huge drill guy. I know you are. I'm not. Like, I see things and I'll say, Adam, how do we make this work into a drill? And Adam goes into the office and comes out and is like, Coach, check this out, or watch this, or we saw this on YouTube. You know, all the work that you're doing, you know, we go to your site, you know, you go to YouTube, you can pick up an inordinate amount of information out there right now, thanks to guys like you, you know, exposing us to it. So, but typical practice day, we're going to practice from 8 to 10 in the morning, in the fall. So guys will get out into the field, you know, 7:15, 7:30. You know, we'll do early work. We'll do 15 minutes of skill sessions. So Adam will take the D and I'll probably take the goalies for a little bit, or we'll flip it around. We'll work on some footwork. You know, basically the week is planned out ahead of time. So there's a progression in the pattern of where we start on Monday to how we end up on Saturday. So we don't go into each practice as a separate entity. We'll have a grander picture of the week as we sit down with the staff and say, all right, defensively, these are the three main objectives. Offensively, these are the three main objectives. Individually, we want to have these three main objectives. And then as a collective group, how do we want to look at the lacrosse team? These are the three objectives. So then from that, we'll build practice plans around what the bigger picture looks like. So, you know, does that make sense? So prior to the week, you know, we'll carve out what we want to look, and then we'll start building practices based on achieving those objectives. And then after each practice, you know, it's analyzed. We have what we call a brief out session. So we'll come back into my office, or we'll go sit around a table, or we'll go out to the park, we'll go get some coffee, we'll do whatever. And for half hour to 45 minutes, we debrief each other. I didn't like this drill. This is why I didn't like it. You know, can we tweak it this way? Mark will say, you know, defensively, Adam, and we're very collaborative here, Mike, and we're very willing to criticize each other with the intent being that, you know, are we getting better here? So, you know, sometimes it's not pleasant. Like, you got to have a little thick skin with our coaching staff. It's never personal. But if we see things we're not liking or it's not working out well, we have to talk about it, because we've got to carve those things away, and we've got to continue to refine our processes to where we're making sure that we're having the largest impact on these kids every single day. That to me is a huge part of this process, is that there shouldn't be a day wasted. We're not getting incrementally better as human beings and incrementally better as lacrosse players. So again, I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, so forgive me. It's just not as
simple. No, you're good. Okay? I think you made a couple of points. You know, it's, you know, as I've gotten older, let me tell you, I recently had a couple guys from the national championship team. They were in Atlanta, and we went out and had wings, and they all love my, you know, they all know my wife. First thing I do with every new team I coach, whether it was Auburn or whoever it is, is I make sure they meet my wife, and I tell them, yep, hey, listen, it's okay to be married 35 years to your best friend, or in this case now, yeah, 41 years to your best friend, yeah, and I want you to meet my wife, and I want you to know that she's part of my life, okay?
Yes.
And, you know, it's hard logistically in today's world to, you know, I'm not Bresh, and I'm not North Carolina. You know, doing Bible studies at Auburn is awkward, or doing Bible studies with a travel team, with kids from all over is awkward, and different ethnicities and different religions. But I tell them, you also need to know that I'm a Christian. Okay.
Yep.
And if my Christianity, if you ever have any questions about my relationship, I know the listeners are turning us off. If you have any questions, I don't give a shit. I mean, if you have any question about my relationship with Jesus Christ, I want you to ask me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've had players come up and take advantage. But the point I'm making is, you know, it's got to be a blend of establishing that cultural-based program or that identity combined with, I guess, on a more pragmatic front, where are our X's and O's?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for 25 years of my career, I had offensive philosophies and defensive slide packages that I liked.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, I was doing a podcast a number of years ago with Sheehan and Lemoyne, and, you know, we were talking about a little bit about fall practices and recruiting, and I said, well, you know, at your level, can you really recruit into your style of play? Because they were pretty up-tempo even at the time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he said the most amazing thing to me. He goes, Mike, we have no idea what our offense is going to look like until October, November.
Correct.
We're not Syracuse.
Correct.
And,
right.
you know, we have to find the pieces that we have and design into it.
Correct.
And I felt so bad because I had been doing it wrong, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been doing it wrong.
There's no right way or wrong way. You learn and you grow and you develop. And I think that's the beauty of coaching. I shouldn't probably say this, but you know, I think the plug and play is sometimes can get stagnant and difficult, and I don't think you challenge yourself or your players that much. I think having to walk out down that field and try out a bunch of kids and then realize like, okay, this is what our attack really looks like. Now, how much better can we get them? You know, can you always increase your shooting? Yes. You know, can you get to become better Dodgers? Yes. You know, can you incrementally increase their IQ? Sure. But it's still, there's a shape that attack group's going to look like on September the 10th that I have no idea what that is going to be. And neither does Mark or Will, right? Well, that's,
well, and you got Dodgers, you got Dodgers and you got post up shooters. And at my level, I don't get guys that can do both.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so you don't whine about it. You just modify your offense so that those guys are in a position to be successful.
And certain little tweaks, you know, can make a huge difference. You don't have to change everything, you know. I think, you know, one thing I learned from David Metzebauer, Metzi and I are great, dear friends. I mean, you know, as grumpy as he is, he's one of the kindest human beings in the whole world. But the one thing I garnered from Metz is that he had an incredible ability to tweak his offense week to week to take advantage of the defenders, whatever defense we were playing, without even hardly getting his team to notice that he was tweaking things, if that makes sense, right? The kids mentally were still dialed in. This is our O. This is the way we do things. And he would just add these subtle little changes that were so creative that the kids didn't even know he was hardly doing it and exposed weaknesses on the other teams. And that's just savvy, and it's veteran, and it's willingness to watch an inordinate amount of film, and that's understanding who you are. I think that's a big component to our success down the road. Is I think what I pray for is our team will clearly have a understanding of what a Utah lacrosse player looks like on the field and off the field, and our staff certainly knows it because they help create it. So. But that's kind of how we start practice, you know, as a whole, and then we'll carve up, the times during the week. So, you know, if we want to focus on transition, we'll probably mix in transition every day. I'm not a big guy that says, okay, this day is strictly a D day. This day is strictly an O day. This day is strictly a riding clearing day. You know, we'd like to keep the flow as consistent as possible and mix in each part of it as the practice goes on. So it's free flowing. We're quick on time. You know, if it, you know, it's 10 minutes, it's 10 minutes. We, you know, stops at 9. We got a 1 minute on the transition and we get to the next drill and the clock goes off and we're moving to the next thing. And, you know, and kids are moving from spot to spot. So the flow is important. I think that's one thing as a coach that I've learned over the years is spending more time looking at the flow of practice, like from what drill to what drill. So even in a transition, you don't want your D going from, like, say, one end of the field to the other to get to the next drill. So if you can sort of combine it and make the flow a little bit easier, then you can move into the next drill, in and out of the next drill quicker. And so diagramming practice that way, I spent a lot more time on wanting the flow to be more productive than having a disjointed practice. Because I feel, again, you know, the quicker you can get in and out of stuff, the more impact you can have, and the better the flow is in practice, the more I think you get out of it. You know, there's times where it gets disjointed and everybody can kind of feel it. Then we make a point of it. We tell the kids, listen, you know, this is just like a game. This is just like a rain delay, right? Things aren't kind of going the way you like it. And sometimes, Mike, we'll totally screw up the flow, because then you get the kids being a little bit of uncomfortable. You talked about Coach Petro, you know, practicing timeouts or half times. You know, I think that's a good strategy, is just putting those kids in some positions, you know, practicing a rain delay. You know, how do you do that when you're limited on practice time? But you can mimic it. You know, you can stop practice. We can go underneath our garage field. I can have the guys break up and split into sessions and have the coach talk, and I can have them sit there for 20 minutes and then say, okay, now let's go back out and resume our scrimmage. You know, see how they handle that. So, and again, I'm jumping all over the place here, but things are just popping into my head.
No, it's all good stuff.
Into what we're trying to cover, so.
You know, and doing the podcast, it's really interesting how coaches address practice flow. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think when we started, and the listeners have heard this 1,000 times, so I'll say it quickly. You know, I think when we started, it was what I say with all the respect I can muster, you know, kind of a Massera model. Fundamentals for an hour, whatever that looks like. I mean, it could be station work, it could be stick work, it could be you name it, you know, ladder work, I mean, whatever. GB drills, I mean, whatever. And then, you know, he might do a little bit of transition and then 6v6 and then 10v10. And 6v6 and 10v10 were close to an hour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, over the years, we've seen coaches intentionally, to your point, disrupt the flow or make it a non-traditional or a non-consistent flow under the umbrella of the players are in a better position to react to the ebb and flows that go on in games.
Mm-hmm.
But not every coach does that. You know, there are some that have actually gone the other way, had gone into that model, and then, you know, whether it's a progression model. I mean, you mentioned Mercer. I can remember... you know, that's close to where I live, so I've gotten to know Kyle really well. And interestingly enough, you know, in the heyday of Loyola, to me on a podcast, kind of gave credit for them redirecting the ball topside rather than through X to things he had seen at Goucher, you know, when Kyle was at Goucher. I actually said that on a podcast, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And Kyle likes to do half field, full field, half field, full field, half field, full field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, no right or wrong way, but...
Yeah.
You know, a lot of interesting thoughts, you know, in like, or he'll do a short field, you know, maybe a three quarter or a full field or whatever it turns out to be. But, and then, you know, we've almost seen a movement back off of transition a little bit.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know, man. I drank the transition.
Not from the youth.
Well, I drank the transition Kool-Aid, you know, with Berkman. I mean, you talked about, is it going to be a transition practice, going to be a defense, a scout practice, right? Yeah. Every one of mine is a transition practice. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Now we got to put some slide work in. Oh, God, I hate that, you know, or whatever it turns out, metaphorically, I mean, whatever it turns out to be.
Yeah.
And the listeners have heard me talk about in the last couple of years, I mean, me personally, you know, I've had to back off the pace of my practice depending on the type of learning style of the players I had. Like when I was at Auburn, we had 70 tryouts to your MCLA point. We had 70 kids try out. I had like 9 kids from the MIAA. Had a starting attackman from your boys at Severn, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And but I had 20 engineers.
Yeah.
You know, and we're banging the ball, redirecting it through X in like a shooting drill, just instead of an up and over, kind of a back and over, you know, to a step down. Just a basic shooting drill. And focusing on redirecting the ball quickly before the goalie goes from one side of the pipe to the other. We got to make 2 passes. And, you know, I get guys going, do you want my foot like this or do you want my foot like that?
No question. Yeah.
You know, and I'm going like, oh, my God. You know, I end up calling, we were talking about Columbus, Ohio. I end up calling CG and Teddy Wolfert, you know, my mentors, going, I'm so messed up, man. They're not reacting to my style of practice. This has never happened in 40 years. You know, and CG started talking about when Pressler was at Wesleyan. They had a very analytical team. They had to do a glossary.
Yeah.
They had to do all the drills and like schematics. I'm going, oh, my God, shoot me. You know, I'll die before I coach like that. But, you know, by modifying my style, the stuff started to resonate a little bit better.
Yeah, but I think, again, you know, that's what creates, you know, just this whole mindset. So just what you just said. So our first year out here, okay, we started out with 38 players. All of these kids were club players here, recruited to play club lacrosse at the University of Utah, which was you can go back and look at their records. They never had a winning season. They never ever beat BYU. The history of the program from a just a pure productive standpoint was one of the worst club programs in all of college NCAA lacrosse. Okay, that's fact. All right, we had started out with 38 kids. We ended up with 26. I bet Mark at the beginning of the season over under was 25. We ended up with 26. And you talk about engineers. We had like 20 some of those kids were engineers. And if people don't understand what we're talking about, they're engineers.
Analytical thinkers.
Has to go to B, has to go to C. If you take C out of the equation, I don't know how to do that. Like, what's next, right? Well, you know, we would run our drills that we've all been accustomed to, things that we've made. And, Mike, we couldn't do them. After the first couple of weeks of practice, I came back in my house. We were working out of our house then, and I just said, boys, we got to rethink everything. Like, we can't do 90% of what we want to institute here. So we started making up and designing drills for those guys to be able to comprehend, to be able to grow within our system. And, you know, it was extremely challenging, very frustrating, but ultimately we ended up 10-6 and we won the RMLC Conference Rocky Mountain Lacrosse League for the first time ever. And we ended up with 25 kids. We got in the playoffs and we lost. We beat Chapman first game of the year. They were ranked number one
great
in the country.
Great team.
And we lost to them in the playoffs. First time Utah ever made the playoffs. And I am bragging here because I'm so proud of those kids to A, stay with us and B, you know, succeed. And that's what they had success on the field. We lost to Chapman in overtime.
Well, they were overachievers.
That's what they were, but they were willing to also meet us. Like, we met them and they met us. Now, you could have approached this a different way where you could have just said, hey, screw this. This is the way we're going to do it, guys, and good luck. We probably would have ended up at 4-12, and it would have been easy for me and the staff to say, well, these kids suck. Okay? That's an approach, right? That's a mindset. But our mindset is to win, and our mindset is to teach, and our mindset is to grow. And so now that carries over forward into this year. You know, we're going to be better and we're going to look better, but we're still going to have some of the same issues when we go play Duke and Virginia and so on and so forth. You know, how do we give them the confidence to maneuver around the field? How do we give them the ability to really accentuate their abilities to the highest level in any kind of environment, you know? And I think that comes through planning and that comes through practice and that comes through repetition. You know, as a coach and a teacher, whatever you want to be good at, you can be good at. You just got to practice it. And so, you know, it's just not one thing. All right. It's a multitude of things. But if you want to be a good shooting team, you can't show them a bunch of diagrams and you can't show them a bunch of percentages and you can't show them, you know, this is the way Duke shoots. You got to be a good shooting team the way Utah is going to be productive, in shooting. It doesn't mean you can't not shoot overhand. It just means that this is the way we're going to be productive, and this is the practice methods we're going to use. And I want to back up on this. So this might be a helping point to some young coaches or coaches out there. So when we do early work, so if we come out to practice and we're going to do early work, OD, special teams, split up or whatever, that focus on early work is exactly what we're going to teach during practice. So I've been a part of programs where you go do early work and it's, you know, footwork. Well, the emphasis on practice on that day is team defense and communication. So why are we doing footwork and early work if we're going to, so we want to teach that early work segment, all right, institute a few things there that you're going to see the rest of practice. So we're, you know, if it's communication is our point of emphasis on defense, then our early work is going to emphasize communication. Now, so, you know, and again, that sounds simple, but some teams kind of, I don't think look at that way. So we just want to make sure it's a building process through this practice of one thing building on top of the other. And it's a curriculum, right? I was never a teacher. But I have a lot of friends that are teachers, and I've spent a lot of time with them understanding their methodology and teaching, and learning more about how one thing builds upon each other. Cause ultimately that's what we are. We're just teachers that we're called by a different name. So I think guys that have masters in education, guys that have taught school, that our coaches have a better handle on that than guys that don't. And I did. So, that's one thing I'm pretty adamant about is spending time with teachers, learning about how they craft and cultivate their curriculum. So, and again, we haven't even gotten to practice yet. So I'm sorry about that.
Coach,
define
the word fun for me. Is that important for your kids to have fun in practice?
100%. 100%.
Yeah, I agree.
100%.
You know, and our listeners know, it's funny. I mean, the guys that are the screamers, right? I mean, Petro and Bill Tierney and, well, I'm Seth Tierney.
Yeah.
even more on Long Island. I mean, really? You know, when are they going to learn to speak English without F-words in Long Island? I don't know if that'll ever
happen.
Well,
I have a similar problem. I'm not proud to admit it. I pray every morning when I go out there, please, Lord, let me, but something happens to me. So if you come to a Coach Holman practice, it's something that just, and the kids like it. They understand it. I apologize in front of them, but they know it's part of me. And
I don't use it anywhere else
than on that field. Go ahead.
You know, you talk about learning environments in a culturally based program. You know, I think one of the reasons I stay focused on transition is not just I use it for touches. You know, I use transition like calisthenics, you know, where we would run a star passing drill before. You know, now we may, you know, run a 3-v-2 with a GB or a ground ball going back toward the end or something.
Yeah.
I don't focus as much on the coaching or the technique as I am us just getting touches, you know. And we have some things that are foundations, you know, that we pitch on the website, non-negotiables, if you would.
Yeah.
You know, one is having fun. One is touches. I mean, we track touches. We get every player 200 touches in the first hour, non-negotiable. And it's really not that hard to do if you modify the drills, you know, so the guys aren't standing around and put our poles in our shooting drills and our goals in a shooting drill.
But
it might be a right hand, left hand pass to a split dodge. You might have the goalie walk the dog. I mean, whatever, you know, but it's just fun because it culminates in a shot, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't even, you know, I should scream more about them shooting overhand or sidearm. In that aspect of the practice, I don't so much care because to me, it's right hand, left hand touches. That's my station work. You know, that's my jumping jacks, if you will.
Yeah.
So, Coach, when you come out of the station work, are you going into something to continue to set the pace of practice? Are you going right into some kind of transition drill to get the blood flowing, or are you going to build in more of a progression style?
Yeah, we'll go station to stretch. So we haven't used stretch yet. These guys come out, you stretch on your own. So you'd be prepared. Station work typically in the first 10 to 15 minutes, it's probably about a 12-minute segment of practice, is more of teaching. So then we'll go stretch. And then right out of stretch, we're getting up and down. We're going right into transition, like right into transition. We want to set the tone pretty much every practice with a transition statement. That could be a full field, that could be a half field, that could be a three-quarter field, whatever it is. And then you start your touches that way. One thing that you mentioned that we do, so whatever drill we're doing, I'll give you an example. We have a drill. It's called cannon drill. People have all kinds of names for everything. And it's basically a full field drill.
No, you are wrong about that. A, you're wrong. I am much older than you, but I have the mentality of a 14-year-old, as my whole family will tell you. And the second thing is, I lost my thought.
That's the old part coming up. Go ahead.
Oh, now you got me twice.
We're talking about names. We're talking about names for drills or whatever.
Yeah, after doing this, thank you for bailing me out, Coach. Now I owe you. God, I'm sucking on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all right. Our listeners, I hope they love me.
They're probably
anyway,
happy. Go ahead.
Coaches suck at naming drills. They suck. You know,
I'm the worst.
I had a good one the other day from Brad Jorgensen down at St. Leo. Man, they had a Cinderella year, huh? You know, he had a Joker drill. But yeah, coaches on my podcast for 10 years, 2 months of podcasts are coaches apologizing for the mundane name of their drills.
Yeah.
So go ahead. What do we call this one? Gunner?
cannon. So you're like shot out of a cannon, right?
All right.
I don't participate. I got a young staff who's got a very aggressive mindset, and they're in charge of naming every drill, and I just try to remember them. I can barely even remember them. But so it could be a full field drill, cannon, attack and D on both ends. You know, we got two lines of midfield pretty much on the sidelines, so to speak, like coming in from a face-off. Be one white and two reds on one side and two reds and one white on the other side. You know, we could roll the ball to them, and it's a 2v1 type of ground ball. If the white guy picks it up, you can make it a 4-on-4. You can add one white guy, or a 5-on-5. If a white guy picks it up, you could add none. It could just be a straight up 4-on-3. We'll call it out ahead of time, but it's an exciting drill. But one thing we'll do there, Mike, is that we'll take all our poles at various times. Sometimes we'll bring them all up together, and they'll be the midfielders, and our short six will play attack and close defense. Sometimes we'll just rotate all the poles up. So every pole is getting a different look and maximum touches, because the style that we want to play is going to be very aggressive. And, you know, if a pole picks the ball up on a ground ball, I'm talking about a close defenseman now, you know, and there's another close defenseman with him. We call it just running six. You know, those three guys, if it's a pole, a midi, and a pole, they're going in transition. So all of our defensemen and our long poles, obviously, are got the handle. So the only way they're going to be able to do that on an effective basis is to do it all through practice, every practice, right? So we'll mix it up. We have another drill, True North. That's from Chris Sanderson, great goalie for Canada. Coach Gittleman, and he's a UVA grad, became friends, and it starts out
I love that drill. I want you to describe it for the listeners, but Brody Merrill was telling us that was his favorite drill.
Yeah, it's one of his. It's your red and white. You know, white behind the goal and red in front. So white comes up from behind as a 3-on-2. Red's defending. And they play it out. Now you can play it out to a shot. You can play it out to a goal. You can play it out to a whistle, whatever you want to do. And then on the next whistle, all right, white turns into a 3-man defense and red adds 2. So it's a 4-on-3. You can change the numbers, obviously, any way you want. But it's 3v2 behind, 4v3 out front, and you just play it out. And it's cool because again, you put guys in really uncomfortable positions. So you can have an attackman coming. All of a sudden, he's got to stay on and play a 3v2. Does he know how to rotate? Does he know how to stop the ball? Is he rotating with his stick to the inside? You know, does he contest shots very well? Or you see a lot about, you know, your personnel that they're in uncomfortable spots. And that's something we constantly try to do, is put our guys in positions to see what they're made of, so to speak. So, you know, everybody likes to be comfortable, right?
Well, I'll tell you what I love the most about that drill is the guys in line got to be paying attention like crazy.
Yeah. You're next
it keeps
up,
the
bam.
Focus of everybody because it runs so quick, and then all of a sudden there's, you know, coming in the other way. The other caveat is for the high school guys, if you want to read about it, just Google Brody Merrill in my search box, and you can see that drill. But the other thing I really, really loved about it was attackman coming up to me. Well, number one, if you're a coach and going to introduce that drill, tell your players you're probably not going to get it the first time you run it, so they don't get frustrated. It takes if you're going to run it for 7 minutes, you may not get it till minute 5.
and it's funny, you know. Honestly, it's funny you say that because it sounds like such an easy thing to do, but guys aren't used to playing. So like you said, an attackman just runs off the field after the whistle blows because you know, I've done my job, right? Well, no, now you're playing. And the other guys, the red guys, as soon as that whistle blows, you're coming in. And then those two guys that were playing defense now have to create space and organize themselves to be able to play offense in a really quick fashion.
Well, it's like you said 15 minutes ago. It's the difference between old-style coaching and new-style coaching, right? I mean, in the old days, we were going to run this drill until you got it, even if the cars were pulled up to the field with the headlights on and I broke two buckets.
You know,
I don't drop F-bombs, but I used to break buckets all the time.
Yeah.
Until I learned that meant I got to put the balls in my trunk without a bucket.
Right.
It took me about 3 practices to understand that. But, I use that phrase a lot when, you know, because I get so many cool drills that are designed for, you know, college talent, and sometimes we have to, you know, modify them for a high school roster. You know, if you got 28 and you don't have 43 or 45.
I often
tell guys, we may not get it today. Don't get frustrated. And during the drill, you tell them, don't get frustrated. Don't get frustrated, you know. But the other thing that drill is killer for.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I've had, over my career, maybe 5 attackmen, good attackmen, not easy to coach attackmen, come up to me and say, I had no clue.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
Until I knew where, if I was standing here, they could skip it across the front of the crease to the backside pipe. I had no idea.
Yes.
Okay. Look where that guy is. If he's 5 yards above the crease and I can bang it from the wing to the backside pipe, I know there's no way they can cover it. There's no way the guy can get there. You know, and they learn that from playing, you know, well, attackmen aren't real good at playing defense in a 4v3. I find they kind of get the hang of it in 3v2. No offense to attackmen.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. So your point is something that we do here. We mix it into our practices. It's not every day, but it's on a pretty steady basis. So we will have all, and you know, including our middies, and what we're going to hope to create here are more two-way middies. But we'll just flip the side. So we'll have our defense play offense, and we'll have our offense play defense. And you know, the point being is defensemen start to see things, view things differently, skip lanes, right? You know, how to maybe anticipate a pass, because now they're seeing it from a completely different view.
Right.
And then offensive players start to read things a little bit clearer. And we've had the same result. We've had a few guys, not a lot, because most of the kids don't like it. So they just turn off the mindset of, what can I get out of this, to, I have to work my way through it.
Or they don't want to admit that they hadn't seen it before, yeah.
Exactly. And so the ego gets in the way, and we try to diffuse a lot of that as we move through these processes. But we've had some of our offensive players, more so we've had probably 6 offensive guys, and we've had 2 or 3 defensive guys talk to our coaches and say, whoa, that made all the difference in the world to me, of just viewing it from that perspective versus always from our perspective. So, you know, and that's not unique. There's other teams doing all that. I don't think we're doing anything here at Utah, besides some of our cultural stuff that is unique to anybody in college lacrosse.
Coach, have you played around with that drill? I can't believe, you know, I do a session at U.S. lacrosse, or I did the last couple of years, how to make any drill 5 drills. So you're not running the same drill every day. You know, it could be an ad. It could be just the positioning on the field, you know, and like
it,
one of the things we do is, you know, we chart ground balls, location, like people chart locations and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And the next day at practice, we'll begin our 3v2 or our 4v3 on where the most ground balls were from the game before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the kids love it, you know, because it resonates. You know, because they were in that play in the game.
Yeah.
Maybe we got it, maybe we didn't. You know, and what we find is that's generally in the alley or balls going back to the end line. But here's my question. Have you ever played around with True North and done it from the wings or up top? I never have.
Yeah. It doesn't flow as quick from the sides, but you can do it anywhere. It's just, again, it's flow, right? So you put the guys over on the sideline. So I like it because, again, you know, we're not unique to this, but we do spend an inordinate amount of time designing drills based on flow of the game. So
I'm still impressed with the fact you used the word inordinate in a sentence appropriately, man. That's pretty killer for a lacrosse.
I can't spell it, but I can say it. So, I'm not a very good speller, or punctuation is.
You're way above your boy Huntley, man. He never had that kind of vocabulary. God rest his soul, my good
friend. Yeah, I know. God bless him was right. One of the things we do here too is, and again, so if we're doing a transition drill, I abhor the old transition drills where a guy stands at midline, rolls the ball out, the kid comes down 4-on-3. Like, in today's world, how many times a game does that happen anymore, right?
Never.
I don't think it ever happens, right?
Never.
Do it. So all of our transition drills are created from game-like scenarios. So it'll be a 3-quarter transition. And, again, I'm not – look, you know, you probably got the wrong guy on your podcast to talk about like drills and, you know, I reiterate this, a bigger picture guy. Like I can see a lot of things. I just don't know. So I'll sit in our room for hours with our staff and say, this is what I see. This is what I think. This is what I think. This is what I see. And they go, okay. And they come back and they go, all right, these are the two new drills we're going to do. This will incorporate that. So, you know, you're looking at 3-quarter transition. Well, why isn't the middie catching the ball at the check down spot, turning around, maybe banging the ball over top of the middie stretching at the box and then creating transition from there or away from the box? Maybe we have an unsettled situation, but there's a pull coming in from the box side of the field, right? So that middie's gotten off. So let's look at the angles that these guys are approaching at and then look at how do we take advantage of where that angle is. And maybe we can create the 3-on-2 on this away from box side really quick. Or not. So, you know, I get more of a kick out of that than sitting around thinking about how to design a drill. I'm more of a vision guy. So again, you're not going to get much on me of like, you know, I can tell you why our drills were created, but I can't tell you how they created them.
Coach, I'm very intrigued with this, dialogue about the guys, creating a drill. Does something come to mind where, those guys came to you with a traditional drill and put a twist on it?
It's almost, to be quite honest with you, Mike, it's almost everything we do has a pro lacrosse, high level thought process version to it. Adam's probably number one on the list. Like, yeah, Adam's a trailblazer is his unique personality trait. And what that is, he's a free spirit. He's a free thought process. The mountains here in Utah fit Adam's personality to a T. So he looks at things totally different. His defensive drills are literally, I would venture to guess there's not 10 guys in the country doing some stuff defensively that he's doing with his guys. So,
Coach, don't treat me like a bait and switch webinar here, man. You got a bait and switch webinar. Give me an example of one of those.
He's just better at it. He, you know, on approaches, you know, just, you know, again, everything's equated to a game, right? So, you know, when you watch film and you make all your notes, so if you're just watching a film for approaches, you know, he's going to interpret those approaches and put them into a skill session that really typify your approach in a game. So it isn't going to be just run out there with your stick out, right? So, you know, Jerry Burns probably the master at this, you know, at taking what lacrosse gives you and then creating drills to do it. So it's you know, being backside help or having being the two responsibility with a skip pass, holding your stick to the inside, you know, hedging to the outside and then approaching, you know, where you want 28 to go. So instead of just approaching this guy, you know, we'll say, you know, he's a predominantly left-handed, alley dodger and we'll make sure in pre-practice, all our guys know this. And so Adam will yell, you know, the skip's going to 28. Well, 28 is going to fight for his left hand. So we're going to approach shading him, all right, to the summit a little bit, not completely, but how do you get that right foot up, all right, and make that approach to force that guy? So those are realistic drills, right? Like, you know, you just, you know, so yeah. For us, even with limited personnel, you can still teach a kid how to do that, right? He doesn't have to be the greatest lacrosse player in the world, but if he does that approach, and as we bump into the crease to release that two slide, who then becomes the hot. Now, how is he sliding if we get that approach right? If he doesn't get the approach right, all right, where are we going to slide adjacent here? Or are we still coming from the crease? And then what's the angle and what's the communication? So, but just repping that over and over and over again. Now, that's not unique, okay? If people are going to say, well, shit, I can go on, I don't know what Notre Dame calls their site, but then whatever, and see that. But it's unique to us on how we structure it. So, and we do that everywhere. You know, Marcus and Will are constantly coming up with, you know, dodge, two-pass look, re-dodge, space, skip, all right, instead of just doing a normal, you know, you know, dodge and skeleton drill, we always have body. Very rarely do we do skeleton offense. Now, some coaches will totally disagree with this. I don't think skeleton, this is my personal opinion, does a lot for your guys. I think some bad habits get developed in skeleton, and I also think some laziness gets developed in skeleton. So we always want some level of pressure with our guys as they're going through their offensive reps and sets, and we will always want some kind of obstruction. So if you're going to throw skip passes, we might stack some football dummies up in the skip lanes. So, you know, we got to throw through those sticks, or you got to get used to not just looking at a wide open area, because that's the problem. Like, a kid visually turns and throws a skip pass and he sees something, it might make that pass go off a little bit. How do you get him used to seeing action in there and still having the confidence to throw the skip pass through the lane? So, you know, again, it's not novel, but we do spend an inordinate amount of time trying to be real. And I think that's important. And we don't get obsessed about it. One thing I'd like to make a point of, Mike, with your audiences too, is, you know, less is more for me. This may sound like I'm not speaking that way, but less is more, right? You know, fundamentally, you've got to do certain things really, really well on a lacrosse field to be successful, right? You've got to have great stick work. You know, you've got to get the ball in and out of our sticks. I think that's a common problem. You see it probably more than anybody with the youth, with the way the sticks are strung and the bags and the whips. And, you know, first thing we do with our team, first thing we do with any team I've ever coached, I have our guys stand 15 yards, 18 yards, 16 yards, whatever the number is, away. And I'll have them step and throw the ball as hard as they possibly can at their teammate. And left and right-handed, I want to see where the ball goes. We spent almost 2 weeks last year. String King has an incredible webinar on how to string sticks. So we had our team on Wednesday nights come in as a group, and we put the webinar up, and everybody strung their own stick, and we stayed there till everybody strung their own stick. And now we've got five or six, maybe seven sticks. Go ahead, say that. Six stringers, really fast, on our team versus one. And we want our guys to understand where the issues come with the whip, how to play better with a little less whip. So we spent a lot of time on that. We spent a lot of time on shooting, and we spent a lot of time on being mentally and physically tough. So again, not novel, but you're going to be good at what you practice. And, you know, but I have a tendency to be less, you know, we're not going to have five clears. You know, let's have two. Let's have one that we do really, really well and that we can maneuver around most rides that we're going to see. And let's have another case that one's falling apart. You know, we're going to ride really, really hard. We're going to 10-man ride people. We don't have to have 3 10-man rides. Let's have one that we can tweak here and there, but let's make sure we're doing it to the best of our ability and we're being consistent with it throughout the year. You know, man up. I'm not a, you know, Coach Holman and Coach Manny and I talk about this all the time. I think sometimes you can overthink yourself on man up. You know, you got to try to get you right. Do you agree or not?
No, I'm laughing, man. One time, like many years ago, like 6 years ago, I'm interviewing Bevel, right? And the man down percentage was 1-1-1. Okay.
Yep.
And I'm going, Bev, you got to talk to me. I don't want your secrets, but how do you drill?
How are you doing this?
Your man down to get down there, you know, and in the true Bevel A, I'm not going to tell you what I really think anyway, mode, although he's very, I mean, his podcast with us are fantastic. But, you know, after about a 4 second pregnant pause, he says, well, what we do is figure out who the shooters are and we cover them.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And you're sitting there going like, before I laugh, let me think about that. You know?
Exactly.
I mean,
when I had 1 year, I coached man down at Carolina. 1 year. We were second or third in the ACC. We were in the top 8 in the country, I believe. I don't know the number. Whatever.
But you were good.
And we were very good. And two things. I will add this to Bev's comment. For us, also it helps having a really smart guy or two in there. We had a kid, Ryan Creighton, out of Philadelphia. That was our short stick on man down. And Crano made up for a lot of ills because he was so dang smart. And he basically knew the offense better than I knew the offense. So it helps to have that, but it also helps just to be real, right? Most man up programs, if you go to the stat book, and you look who's scoring their man up goals, there's usually one or two guys that are scoring 90% of. So how do you eliminate them without having to go shut them off or and make their lives miserable and make so what's so hard about that, right? I mean, I don't know. I just don't think
less is more, somebody told me one time.
You know, less is more. And Coach Tierney's great quote, and he still uses it, I think, and Billy and I go way back, and I adore that man, and as many people do in lacrosse, but, you know, you cut the head off of the snake, right? You know, I go back to 2013 quarterfinal game. Carolina plays Denver and Indianapolis, and, you know, we were up 9-4 at halftime. We had that team was on a 10-game win streak. It was Coach Holman's senior year there. We had a really, really good lacrosse team all the way across the board, a great team. You know, Billy made Mark's life miserable. But he couldn't get the ball. And I'm not saying it's because he's my son. I'm just saying it because that's what Coach T's really good at. Like, he's the best player on the team. He scored 7-8 goals against those guys last year in the playoff game. And, you know, he told me afterwards, he's like, there's no way Marcus Holman was beating us in this game, right? So, you know, and we end up losing the game. And not necessarily just because of that, but because that created a lot of issues on how we were going to do other things offensively. So, I just don't overthink it, man. It's a beautiful game. It's an awesome game.
End of the day, I think the one thing that age teaches you too is that, and I say this in coaching clinics that I do, not on my stuff, but what I've learned from great guys like you is all the time. You know, and Bill Tierney said in a podcast something really interesting, and I don't want to get the words wrong or put words in his mouth, but to the effect that Saturdays is the day we do the least amount of coaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I, in my clinics, I'm going, you got to understand, man, players make plays.
Yeah.
Right? And it doesn't matter what your X's and O's are. You know, players got to make plays. Now, you know, you got to get them prepared to make plays. That's your job.
Monday through Friday is where I earn my living. And I told my team all the time, there's nothing more for better, greater for me as a human being to come out on Saturday and literally just not have a lot to say, but just how happy I am with you guys play. Like, just keep it up. Keep going. Now, halftime,
even win or lose, I say that. If we're playing well,
if you're doing
we're playing
the best
well.
You can, forget all the rest of it. The score is inconsequential. It's inconsequential. It's all about the effort, and it's all about, you know, the team focus during that event. And if that is at the level that we expect out of a Utah lacrosse player, I don't care. We lost our last game last year to BYU in the championship. Everybody was pegging us to win a national championship, the NCAA, and we lost in a quarterfinals to BYU. And they
was that
played
an overtime game?
No, we lost with 3 seconds left to go. We were
okay,
up by
I knew
two.
It was close at the end.
I screwed up at the end of the game. We were up by two. We had a transition segment. It was over 2 minutes left to go in the game. I had one timeout left, and we never put our foot off the pedal in transition all year long. It's the way we played. We had a green scenario, and we took a great shot. Goalie made a heck of a save. They cleared the ball, get a scrum up by midfield line, and our best player, our toughest player, our best attackman, takes this kid out, which arguably could be called a bad hit, a good hit, whatever. If it was 15 years ago, it would have been a great hit. If it,
right.
it was this year, it's a 1 minute non-releasable penalty, right? They score, they get the ball back, they score again, and they score with 3 seconds left to win the game. My fault, should have called timeout probably looking back at it, but it was against our grain. If I had to do it over again, yeah, but you don't get those chances, right? Those are learning opportunities. My point to all this is just what you said. All right, my message to the team afterwards, a bunch of heartbroken young men, was, hey, A, this is life, okay? We learn and move on. B, you played as hard as you possibly could play. Didn't play as well as you could possibly play, but you played as hard as you possibly could play. There wasn't a kid that stepped on that field that didn't give everything he had for that game, all right? C is your opponent played better than you. That's the way this works, right? That's the way this works. You know, and that was it. That was the message. That was the end of the game. We moved on. And that to me, you know, is the way you have to approach this. You know, but the work's done Monday through Friday. I, 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 you know, I get in our kids. You can tell by some of those videos. I hold them to a very high standard. I go back to our Hopkins days, Mike. This is a long time ago, man. But I don't think it changes much. Our toughest opponent, when I played at Hopkins, and I played in 4 straight national championship games. And I know it may be tough to replicate that these days. I do get that. But our toughest opponent was our team, was the guys, the guy that sat behind me and arguably a lot of people think he should have been playing over me was Larry Quinn, but he didn't beat me out. So he was our backup goalie when I played there. And I love Larry, arguably one of the best goalies that ever played lacrosse, but that was the depth of talent that we had. And our practices were vicious. We're vicious when I tell you that. So when Saturday came, our guys were like, shit. I mean, this isn't even close to what we saw all week. And I'm going to try to replicate that the best that I can without wearing our guys out. So there's a fine line there, right? What you have to adjust for, in today's environment is most young men aren't used to working that hard, at their schools these days. And so when they come here, I've got to do a great job recruiting because I'm going to expect a lot out of them and I'm going to teach them how to work at the level that we need them to work at. But you got to be careful recruiting a lot of kids that aren't used to working that hard or come from programs that don't work that hard because the culture shock sometimes is too much for them to handle.
Well, I think that one of the huge things, you know, and I learned it from being a high school wrestler. But I think what you have to learn is that, and my daughter, who's an all-state volleyball player, now a PhD, you know, attributes this to me. She said, you taught me the correlation between hard work and success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think the kids that are big-time recruits, and this is a macro generalization, I get it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, they have not had to work hard. Now, you get, like the comments you made about your staff. You know, where you get guys that are overachievers or work hard, you know?
Yeah.
And the first indication is the guy that's on the field earlier, the guy that stays late, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all the time. Yeah. Coach, coming back to that championship game, the BYU game, let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do next time? You going to let those kids come down and transition or are you going to yank them out?
I don't know. The field.
I don't know either. I ask you, you know, the listeners can talk amongst themselves. We're about to wrap up, but you know, at the end of the day, it's the ultimate conundrum, isn't it? I mean,
but that's what makes it fun. Like that.
Yeah, we've been on both sides of it, right? I mean, there's been times when I called timeout and they put a defensive scenario in we hadn't seen and, you know, we didn't react well and it worked against us. There's been times when, you know, I have bit my tongue on the sidelines and said, Mikey, trust your kids. Trust your kids. Okay.
Yep.
But I know one thing, you know, the one result of that is practicing the end of games in practice to your earlier point. You know, I want them to be familiar with what the options are and when to go and when not to go. And if it's even close, don't go. And to be honest with you, much to my chagrin, you know, with a 2-goal lead, I slowed things down at the end of the game where I hadn't done that for 35 years.
I know. I'm with you, Mike.
And I'm not saying I'm right or wrong. I'm just saying it's something, personally, I wrestle with.
But that's the beauty of it. If I had a chance to do it over again in that same game, I probably would do the same thing. You got to understand, we got a 12-yard step down from dead center of the goal with one of our best left-handed shooters. Kid shoots the ball. He strokes it over the top. We score there. We're up 3 in that game. It's all over. All right. And he strokes a high to low off stick and the kid throws his foot out and hits his toe and bounces out to their guy, right to their guy. My thing is that kid had to make an exceptional play for them to win the game and he did it. Kudos. 9 times out of 10, if I shoot that lacrosse ball, Quinault shoots it. I don't shoot it. He shoots it. 9 times out of 10, that ball's going in the goal. So I give them credit and he made the play. If he doesn't make the play, we win, right? So I think if I'm true to who I want to believe I am, I think we continue to press in those scenarios, and I think we're going to win more games than I lose. Now, as a feel, if it got messy and we all of a sudden it's all even and things are settling down, I call timeout because we're done with that scenario. But we were still in a heavy green. They screwed up the
subbing.
Exactly
what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. And so the scenario presented to me, if it was the same scenario again, I'd do the same thing. If the scenario tweaks a little bit, I probably call timeout. But the beauty of it is that was a great teaching moment for me and my staff and how would I process it through. And it gave me time to think through it. And if I feel that same scenario again, I'll maybe be better prepared for it. I don't know. But I think that's the fun of this profession. It's just constant. Every day is a new day and you're dealing with a lot.
I think the key thing is, A, are you learning? You know, are you growing?
It's everything. It's everything. Every day. Look at what you do every day.
I challenge coaches in my clinics all the time. Going like, yeah. You want your kid on the wall. You want them lifting weight. How many videos are you looking at in the off season? How many game films, the teams you respect, are you looking at in the off season? I mean, you know, what coaching clinics are you going to? And you don't have to listen to me. I mean, God, there's a lot of people. I mean,
sure.
You know, if you got $1 million, Jamie Monroe's putting out great stuff, you know. No offense to Jamie Monroe.
I got it. It's awesome.
I'm sorry. That was out of line. I'll edit that out.
I love it.
Hey, listen, I want to be respectful of your time. Coach, in your plans, understanding that the timing of this is coming into fall 2018, we try and keep these as timeless as we can, the podcast, so people can listen to them. But at the end of the day, do you see yourself doing prospect camps out there and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we've had great success with that, Mike. So if people go to our it's www.uteslacrossecamps.com.
Okay.
Or if they just go to our regular website,
We'll get that up on the
camp,
site too.
Campsite. Yeah. And, we have two, we just finished one here, July 30th and 31st. We had 80. I cut them off at 75. I just don't feel that we can effectively teach
and
coach
to.
On one field. And I love
those
camps.
You don't want it to be a money grab either, you know?
It's
I
not.
Mean, so
it's
many
not.
Of these
we
guys are like, yeah.
$150, and it's 6 hours. But I, for any young men out there, and you touched on this earlier, if you're really interested in a school and a coaching staff, there's no better way to get a feel than to go to their prospect camps. You get to go on campus. You get to take some time and walk around the school without any pressure. You get to see their coaches in action. All whole staff is here for that. We run it very similar to the practices that we run. So you get a feel for the level of intensity. We have all of our players work the camp, so we had 10, 11 of our guys. So you get a feel for what does their existing team look like. Man, there's not a better way to get recruited, number one, and get a feel for who you're dealing with, number two. So, but we have one coming up at the end of September, and we have one coming up at the end of October. So
we'll get that on the site.
Yeah, youth lacrosse camps, or just youth lacrosse, and look for the camp button. On there.
Oh man, hey listen, stay on the line with me. We are way over our time. I gotta sign off. I got 5 pages of notes here and my head is spinning about what I'm gonna write about. Anyway, Coach Holmes, thank you so much. This is LastCoachMike.com. If you gotta understand, you know, you got tremendous responsibility influencing lives of these young people. Take it serious every day from the moment you plan your practice and you'll have more fun and your teams will be awesome. Until next time, LastCoachMike.com. See you later, everybody.